When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 92 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast, with a new episode released every single day. You get an extended interview like this one every Monday, and short 4 or 5 minute daily episodes Tuesday through Sunday on a show that I call This Day Rocks. Loads of classic rock content for classic rock fans. Now, today's interview is with a man with an incredible voice and an incredibly diverse mix of music, from working with the Bee Gees to Ritchie Blackmore, Yngwie Malmsteen, and Stevie Vai. I am, of course, talking about the brilliant singer Graham Bonnet. Of course, he fronted Rainbow, he fronted Alcatraz, he fronted Michael Schenker's group, and he is still going strong today. He's a real storyteller as well, with a big smile and a great wit in his delivery. It's a longer interview, so I hope you really do enjoy it. But first, as always, a quick plea to make sure you're following Vintage Rock Pod on the social media channels. If you're on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, whatever you're active on, just search for Vintage Rock Pod and press the follow or like button or whatever it's called on whichever one you use. And if you can, hit like, leave a comment, or share the posts as well, because it helps to spread the word of the podcast, and it may show up in other people's feeds and pique their interest too. And we get more listeners on the podcast that way. It really does help. Also, check out the Vintage Rock Pod YouTube channel for videos with these classic rock stars. You get to see them all. Plus, you take part in the daily poll along with a couple thousand other people as well. Again, just search for Vintage Rock Pod and hit subscribe. It's absolutely free on YouTube. And finally, check out Pantheon Podcasts. It's the network for music fans. The Vintage Rock Pod is a proud part of it. So many great shows on there. I think there must be, 100 great podcasts on there. There's something for everyone, so please do check them out. It's Pantheon Podcasts, and have a scroll through all the brilliant podcasts that are on there. Anyway, back to Graham Bonnet then. We delve deep into the captivating journey of Graham Bonnet's career. We begin by exploring his early days, including his breakout hit going top 10 in the UK with the Marbles, and the stories behind the scenes with the Bee Gees that propelled him towards stardom. Of course, we discussed that fateful moment when Bonnet joined the legendary band Rainbow, led by none other than the guitar virtuoso Ritchie Blackmore. We uncover the fascinating tale of how this collaboration came to be, and of course, the infamous story that Blackmore likes to tell about Graham cutting his hair. But that's not all. We go beyond the headlines and we dig into the heart of the matter, find out the real reasons behind Bonnet's departure from the band and the challenges he faced. We talk about his great solo album and his time starting Alcatraz and working with Yngwie and the bust up which led to Yngwie leaving and then him recruiting Steve Vai too. Plus, the conversation doesn't stop there. We also explore Graham Bonnet's new music, giving you an exclusive glimpse into his latest projects and what lies ahead for this iconic rock singer. So please, enjoy this brilliant conversation with a great rock vocalist, Graham Bonnet. Let's go back to 1968 then, first of all, The Marbles. I'd love to hear about this song because this isn't something that many people remember or know about, to be honest with you. You had a big hit, Only One Woman, didn't you? Got top five in the UK. So tell us a little bit about how that came around.
Well, it was because, my cousin used to be in the Bee Gees. My cousin and I lived together when, it sounds weird, my cousin's parents went to Australia, took him to Australia. My uncle was a bricklayer. So in the summertime in Australia, he went to their summer. Then he would come back to our summer, the British summer. And one day they decided that they should probably leave my cousin Trevor with my mum and dad and me. That's what happened. Anyway, my cousin Trevor Gordon, he was guitar player in the Bee Gees when he lives in Australia. And so we were, we were rehearsing in Skegness by the sea. And my cousin said, we should move. We've got to get down to London. So we went to London, all five of us, I think we were. And we played in a place called the Revolution Club in London. And what happened was in the audience was the Bee Gees' old manager. And after the show was over, he came over to Trevor and said, hey, Trevor. And my cousin goes, I think his name is Ozzy or something. He said, hey, Ozzy, how are you? And he said, hey, I'm sure the boys would like to see you again, the brothers, the Bee Gee brothers, the brothers. And so he gave Trevor Barry's telephone number, and my cousin Trevor went down that next day to meet up with Barry. And what Barry and the other boys wanted to do was start with the left off, begin with the left off kind of thing, when Trevor left the band, so to speak, because he didn't come to England until much later. They moved to England and became sort of famous. And I'm doing this all backwards a bit, but anyway, it'll make sense. I think I am. Anyway, he said to Barry, my cousin's a singer too. And so Barry said, well, bring him along tomorrow or whatever. And so a couple of days later, me and my cousin and I, we went down to Barry's house. And we started singing, playing our guitars and singing Stevie Wonder and whatever, Beach Boys and Beatles and everything you can imagine, which was great. All this harmony coming out there with those boys. My God, it was great. And in the room was Robert Stigwood, who was the Bee Gees manager, and said to Barry, Barry, do you have a song for these boys? And Barry said, no. He said, I'd like to have them in the studio within the next week or two. And that's how we kind of started. The Marbles began there. And so Barry had this la-la tune. He lied to me. He plays guitar. And he lied, la-la'd this tune to me. And anyway, we went into the studio and I did a quick da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and my cousin says, Graham, instead of going down on that particular note, why don't you go up? And Barry said, oh, that's a great idea. So the melody was changed by my cousin, you little bugger. So it went up, it went up to a C-sharp. So it didn't go da 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 da. That because it was all that in that same register. So it went da 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 da. So that was the beginning of Only One Woman. My cousin is, I guess, songwriter for that a little bit. But that's how it started. So in a couple of days, Barry wrote some words, and we went in and recorded Only One Woman with that extra note put in there. And thank you, Trevor. My cousin passed away a few years ago. And he was found in his apartment, which was, he passed, I think, 5 years ago. And he was the one that got me into playing guitar and everything, when we were kids, when we were 11 or whatever. Well, that's how we started. It's kind of the Marbles was born in Barry Gibb's house.
Wow, phenomenal stuff. And very sad to hear that your cousin's passed away. Now, as you said, so that was a top five hit, and then you had another hit after that. So from that kind of roots in the Bee Gees, and you were more kind of R&B as well at this sort of stage just before then. So when you were approached by Rainbow, obviously a rock band and Wizards and Fairies and all this sort of stuff, at this stage, when you were approached by them, you didn't actually know anything about them, did you? You had no idea who they were.
No, I haven't. My manager said to me, there's this band called Rainbow would like to, audition you for to be their new singer. And I said, Rainbow, I thought you sound like a folk group. Like, Rainbow, it sounds like a folk group almost. And he said to me, they used to be Deep Purple. Now they've changed the name. Roger Glover is still playing bass and Richie Blackmore is guitar player. They changed the name to Rainbow. So what happened was he wanted to send me over to Switzerland where they were recording. And he said, you better learn some of their songs. And then anyway, he got in touch with me and said, learn this one. It's called Mistreated. And I learned that one song and I went over for the audition. And to make a short story even longer, they gave me the job. But what happened was I was so scared of, fucking up, to put it mildly, on this song. I thought, well, I won't sing it on microphone. I will sing it off mic. So the mic was over there somewhere. And the band was playing very loud. And I sang the thing, and when it was over, they were all laughing. And I thought, oh, crap, was it really that bad? They stared at me and said, yeah, let's do it again. And okay, then we did it again. I was still off microphone. Then Don said, Don Airy said, Graham, how about this time you sing on mic this time? So the third time through, I sang on microphone. They were just overjoyed. You said, you're the guy. Anyway, I went back to England saying to my manager that I didn't think I was right because this wasn't what I was used to singing. I do not R&B, pop, whatever, not like this, which is sort of semi-classical sounding music, very, very sort of heavy for back then. Mm-hmm. And so he said, no, you've got to do this. It'd be good for your career. It was good for his wallet. My career, I'm not sure. No, it didn't. No, it was great for my career. I mean, I got a lot of recognition because I did join Rainbow, and I thank Richie Blackmore for taking me in and the guys. It was such a great, great journey, and I'm
so pleased that So how did it happen then? Because obviously you weren't spotted singing rock songs and things like that. So what was it that I'm guessing Richie had heard or seen? What was it that picked you out of the crowd then?
Well, it's because of that song, Only One Woman. Okay. They were playing a game, Spot the Tune. Had the cassette machine there, and Cozy would play Spot the Tune. But who's this? Then who's this? Then who's this? And my song and my cousin's song came up, and Richie said to Cozy, what's he doing now? Do you know this guy? Oh, I heard he lost his voice. Oh, okay. Then so he's not working anymore. Then Roger Glover chimed in and said, well, no, he hasn't lost his voice. He's managed by same management as who am I thinking of? Oh, Mickey Moody. And Mickey Moody was recording with Roger Glover, Whitesnake, the beginnings of Whitesnake. And we're managed by the same management company. He said, no, he's working with my manager, David Oddie. So anyway, I was, they picked me out to come audition. So it was, I didn't know what to expect. And I just didn't think I was right for the band. But anyway, I went back again and we started recording. And it was, I was like, oh, crap, what do I do here? So Roger said to me, look, I'll help you through with some of the melodies and then I'll write the words. I said, okay, that's good for me. And so Roger wrote the words and he gave me a brief outline of the melodies and I would sing it my way, I'd interpret it, whichever way I wanted, A bit like The Only One Woman, really. Sort of ad lib, I'm going, off you go. And it's all my cousin's fault that the C sharp and a D even comes into all my songs ever since. Wow. So anyway, but that's kind of how it all began. And it was a lot of fun. Roger taught me a lot. Roger Glover was a great teacher and a great producer, apart from anything else, and songwriter. So we made the album in that way. Roger will give me a rough idea how the melody should probably go with the lyric written. And I would just ad-lib and, you know, not that one. Oh, this one. So we recorded each song was recorded four times. And Rich would come in and he would pick out which one he liked best. Now, this one. Oh, it's not as good as the other. Anyway, that's how we did every song. So it took a long bloody time to record because it was all kind of ad-lib and, oh, this one, that one. No, you know, but I like that one best. But it was... It was a great learning tool for me. It really was. And I thank Rich and I thank Roger so much, well, whole band really, for putting me in that position of being a student of sort of heavy rock, I guess, which I wasn't. But now I guess I am.
And let's be honest, there's not many better people to be learning from than the names you're talking about there, Richie Blackmore and Roger Glover and Don Airey and Cozy Powell, obviously. I mean, you went into a group of superstars, really, didn't you?
Oh, my God. I mean, how could you fail in such a band? I mean, I said, you know, afterwards, when we went on stage, I would say, how do you feel when you walk in front of, you know, 20,000 people, whatever the hell? I said, well, I always felt comfortable with the band, no matter how shitty I felt. Once I walked out on stage and those guys were behind me, how could it fail? If I croaked or messed up in a song, it didn't matter. You know, these guys were so good, you know. But I never felt nervous. I always felt excited about going on stage with them because they were so damn good. And as I said, how could you fail? Cozy, Don Airey, Roger Glover, Richie Blackmore. Come on, you know, the best.
Indeed.
I was lucky enough.
Absolutely.
At that particular time.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you mentioned the fact that obviously it was a change for you, but it was a change for the band as well and in kind of direction. And let's be honest, people, us humans, we don't deal traditionally well with change. So did you get any negative feedback or anything like that during the early time of your being in the band?
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month. So just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
Yeah, at first, yes. I remember the very first show we did was in an arena somewhere. I can't remember what city it was in. But it was in the States. And there are some guys down front of the stage. They were like heckling me and go, oh, get up, we were Ronnie, you know, calling out for Ronnie Dio. I expected it anyway, you know. I mean, Ronnie was a great singer, you know, bless his heart, you know, wherever he may be. And they were doing all this, you know, I couldn't concentrate. And Richie looked at me and he started playing this D chord in a very ding-ding-ding-ding-ding arpeggio. And I knew what that song was. It was a song called Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? So I went and sat down on the stage in front of these guys and looked them straight in the eye and said, tonight you're mine completely. And they started laughing. And from that moment on, I was in. I was part of the gang. You know, so it shows that I was a human being and I didn't mind being made fun of, if you like, where, you know, shouting out, get your bloody haircut, whatever it may be, you know. And I was the only short-haired guy in the band, for Christ's sake. But anyway, that from that day on, I felt very comfortable about going on stage and not being heckled, you know, for some reason. It's just that one night, the first night, you know.
Wow.
You know, nerve-wracking for me because first damn night, Cozy was so nervous. I'll never forget that. He kept going to the bathroom. Oh, gee, what's he doing? You know, I go for a piss again. Oh, really? And he said, Graham, you're going to be all right. I said, are you? You're probably more nervous than I was. But anyway, very successfully after that little confrontation with those guys. And they were so nice after that, you know. They were laughing at Graham. All right, bud, you're okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And the record Down to Earth, it was a huge hit here in the UK. In fact, it was a higher charting album than any of the previous Rainbow records that had come before it, which is fantastic. I mean, All Night Long, it's a classic. But we're going to talk about Since You've Been Gone. I mean, it's world famous. It's got a legacy as well to it. And I saw recently you posted on your social media about the fact that it had been used on the trailer for the upcoming Guardians of the Galaxy movie, which means it lives on. It's finding new audiences now as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, a lot of people have, I took my kids to see this, and when we heard your voice, we told them who you were, you know, all that is coming out now, and it's a great, fucking great. I mean, I don't know how much will help my career, but it's so nice to hear that song on a movie, you know, fantastic. And I was very surprised when Bethany, my girlfriend, she said, listen to this, Guardians of the Galaxy promo. So, what? And she played. I said, that's me. She said, yeah, I know. And so the rest is history, I suppose. We'll see what he does. I hope I do gather more, you know, younger viewers, listeners, whatever, from them. But their parents or their grandparents are saying, I know him. It's our Graham from Skegness. Yeah, so, you know, I don't know if it'll help, but it's a great honor to be part of that movie. Those movies are so popular.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the song itself, I mean, take me back to that time in the recording studio. As you said, you were doing three or four versions of the song. Can you, of all the songs on the album, sorry. So in terms of that one, can you remember getting it down? And was there a general consensus about which one was going to work? Because it is such a classic.
Oh, with that, you see, with Since You've Been Gone, that was already written. So, we heard it'd been recorded, I think, four times before we did it. And okay. The version I heard was by a band called Clout, which was a girl band. And I heard this and nobody liked it. I mean, I remember Chloe's going, oh, look, we're not going to do that. I mean, oh, shit. You know, it was nobody liked it because it was very, very, very popular. Yeah, I remember the way they did it was Since You've Been Gone. It wasn't whatever I did. It was very, very sort of very light and airy, non-airy. And so it had to be changed a little. And I love that the way that guitar starts the song off. That's Richie Blackmore 100%. That sound here. Yeah. Identifiable. You know, and so we made it a little heavier, but not too much, you know. So instead of going, duh, 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 ba-doo, I went, whoa, you know. And we were encouraged by our management, by Bruce Payne. He said, that's fucking good. That's good. That's it. This is it. We're going to get radio play now. And that's the reason it's done, to get, be more radio friendly, which it became, here in the States. And all over the place, you know, so good mood, you know. Nobody likes it, but then after that, we all liked it, you know. Yeah,
I bet. And just something that you get asked a million times, I'm sure you do, and you mentioned it just a few minutes ago as well, that the famous haircut thing, the very famous video of Richie talking about the haircut and having you locked in a room and you snuck out to go and get your haircut, and then he was raging with you, and that's one of the reasons he fired you and all this sort of stuff. And I know you've rubbished it over the years, but can you tell us a little bit more about that famous story?
Yeah, it's he's embellished that story a bit. He's adding to it every time I hear. I'm surprised that story is still traveling along after all these years. What actually happened was we were in, I can't remember what, maybe even in Scotland, I think, actually. And I was with my ex-wife, and my hair was getting like this, like it is now. I've been off the road for so long. We go back on the road in a month. But I didn't have my hair cut when I was off the road, you know. And you could see, but I fucking ponytail back there. Anyway, so I was walking around the city with her. I think it was Edinburgh. And my hair was quite as long as this. And I said to her, I'll go and get a haircut while you go and shop, you know. So I went to get a haircut. And that was it. That's all I did. And there was no guard on the door or anything like that. In fact, I saw our road manager, about 3 months ago. And we were talking to him and laughing about that story. He said, I wasn't put on the door to guard you. I said, I know, but isn't that a great story? So I just done my haircut, and So I walk out on stage that night. You know, Richie hadn't seen me all day. We never saw each other all day. It was always just showtime. That's when we all see it, saw each other. And I would sort of come on last. You know, they're doing the intro to a song called Eyes of the World, the intro song. And I come, you know, running on. And he looks at me and he goes, flabbergasting. And he disappeared. He went behind the amps. He went behind the stage and didn't come out. And he played there all night. And next day, Richie called a meeting. He said, you know, I want to see everybody in my room. We all went to his room in the Holiday Inn somewhere. And we walk in and everybody said, oh, what is it? What's the matter? You know, I thought it was something really serious. And he looks at me and he goes, it's Graham's hair. And everybody burst out laughing. You're like, what? You called a meeting about that, you know. And Cozy just said, oh, you know, you can imagine what he said. Give me a fucking break. And everybody else said, what about his hair? You know, well, he had it cut. I thought he was being mean to me, you know. I thought he was insulting me by having his hair cut because I'm always saying his hair's too short. And he always did. He always said, well, yeah, it's a bit short, you know. And because everybody else in the band had longish hair. It wasn't long, it was longish. And so that was the meeting. And everybody just thought he was a complete fool. But Richie, bless him, he asked for that story. As I said, every time I've seen that interview or another interview, he brings that up. And it's magical. Because I didn't know what I did that day, but he's telling me what I did. You know, there's guard on the door. And I went out the window. And then what happened? You know, I'm waiting for something, you know, hit by a car, but he still kept going. You know what I mean? It adds a little bit, but I think it's good just going out the window is good enough because we're like seven floors up, you know, so, you know, by the way, you know.
But it's, tying the bed sheets together, yeah, that's it.
A fucking parachute, you know. But it's, Richie, bless him, I know after that, you know, I know he loves me. I love him too, you know. And after that, everything calmed down in the head. Whatever, you know. You know, have a fucking, you know, your head shaved, you know. It was okay after that.
Fantastic. Love that story. And you mentioned in there that you love Richie and he loves you. I mean, he's got a reputation, obviously, as being one of the greatest guitarists of all time, but as well as being someone that can be difficult at times. That's probably a nice way of putting it. So what was your memories of working with Richie? What's your relationship like with him?
Well, that was the most difficult thing I had was a haircut.
Oh, well, there you
go. Musically, no damn problem at all. You know, he was always, Brian, what do you think of this? You know, it always, when he and Roger worked together, you know, Richie would be playing his guitar. I remember one night, he came in and he said to me, do you know that Rolling Stones song? Oh, crap. No, call me what it is. one second, I'll get it in a minute. Out of Time. It's a song called Out of Time. Baby, 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 you're out of time. He said, I've got this idea, you know. This idea is sort of like that, you know. Da 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 da. Because the melody is the same as that song. All night long, because you thought you were a clever girl. And Chris Farlow did it, a guy called Chris Farlow. And that was a hit record in England, I seem to remember. And he said, you know, strumming. I said, okay, well, I'll make up a melody around that. And that's what happened with that, you know. But we always got on pretty good, you know. And that was just one moment where he said, well, you can make something up of this. Roger will write the words. You know, and it's pretty much a complete rip-off, the melody-ish, sort of. It's not exactly the same, but, you know, I don't think the Rolling Stones would mind. Yeah, I mean, and that was a hit record again. We did very well with that song. Yeah. But he was always very open to me, and before every show, he would say, what time are you going to come down to my dressing room? I said, well, what time are we on? Oh, we're on at 8. So we'll come down about, you know, 22:00. And I go down and I sit with him. And he said, what can we do tonight to fuck everybody up? There'll be something we could do to put you up. And I remember one night he said, what we should have after Cozy has done his drum solo, which you come out with, cards, 7 out of 10, all like that, just for a laugh. And that's what we did one night. That was one joke we played on Cozy. We go, what the fuck are you doing? We're all walking across the stage with these numbers, which is kind of funny. You had to be there, I think. It was a funny moment. But little things like that we would make up, and I can't remember some of the other things, but that's one I particularly remember because we all just went, walking across the stage. It was so funny because his drum solo is like epic. I mean, just amazing, So every night, 9 out of 10. Oh, I don't know. You don't take the 9. You take the 9. But bless his heart, he was. He could take a joke, and he could take a joke just like I can. We all could.
Fantastic.
You can't be too serious on this. And I know everybody's like, snails. The heavy metal thing, but it's not really like that. What we're doing is we're playing a different person when we go on stage. We really are. Two different people. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then the fact that you had the big album, you had the two big singles off the album, big records, everyone remembers them. But despite all that, it kind of all fell apart by the time the second album for you kind of came around, didn't it? And that was what kind of left you, made the decision to leave the band.
Yeah, well, we were rehearsing in Copenhagen trying to write the next album. And we had a new drummer because Koji had left. So we had this new drummer with huge fucking hairdo and talk about hair. And we will go to this rehearsal room, and some days there'll be like two people there. Another day there'll be three of us there. One day there'll be just me there. Nobody was interested, especially Richie. I'm just supposed to be, making up new songs for the new album. And I think the laziness was because we had a song from Russ Ballard again, a song called I Surrender. And that's the only song we had. And I said to Roger Glover, I said, well, what are we going to do? We haven't got anything. He said, well, we've got I Surrender, the Russ Ballard tune. He said, do you want to go in and do the backing harmony? I said, we'll start there at least. So I went in and did some backing harmonies, which weren't used in the end, I don't think. And that was kind of it. I didn't do a lead vocal on it at all. And it was it wasn't productive at all because Richie wasn't coming in and showing us what to do, And some days he would. And anyway, it just got to like, well, what the fuck are we, what are we doing? We have nothing. And time was passing by. And, the album was starting recording like yesterday. And we got to I Surrender. Yeah, okay. Well, what else have we got? So, be sitting looking at each other. And Don Airy says, I'm going to go home. Oh, no, don't go home, Rob. Come on. No, Don. I need you here because me and Don are very, me and Don and Cozy, very close, three musketeers. And when Cozy was gone, it was like, oh, fuck, kidding me? Anyway, Don says, I'm going. I don't like the drummer and everything. He says, Cozy's gone. It's not the same. And nobody's turning up for rehearsal anyway. So he said, I'm going to go home. And I said, well, if you go home, Don, I'll go home too, because I'm not finding this very interesting or exciting at all either. Nothing's happening. So I went home, and he didn't. he stayed. He said, you bloody bastard. So he stayed. And I thought, I said to him, I thought you were going to leave. And he didn't. And I got a phone call from our manager, the band manager, who said, well, are you coming back for him? I said, no, I want to do something else. And I thought Don was going to leave. Don's still with the band, yeah? Yes, he's still with the band. He said, I don't know what to do. He said, well, we found another singer. And if you come in and sing the song you like and let this other singer sing the song you don't like, whatever that means, and we'll go that way. I said, no, that doesn't work. Two singers in Rainbow? Nah. No, I can't see that, And so I left the band. I wasn't fired, although people like to think I was because I had another haircut or something. Oh, come out the bathroom wet hair. Sorry about that. That was it for me. And I found a guy in L.A., a guy called Andy Truman, who had a good reputation. He managed Jethro Tull, the Bay City Rollers, a bunch of different people, you know, all different genre. And one of my friends introduced me to him, and he took over management. And so he said, well, Graham, what you should do is get yourself a band together. And that's how Alcatraz was formed, in my garage. Calabasas. And that took a while too. But that's what I wanted to do, was form my own band that was similar to Rainbow, have the same kind of lineup, keyboards, guitar, you know, bass, you know, that kind of a line. And that's what happened then, you know.
Indeed, and let's just talk about that, because the album lineup came out and it had a huge song on it again. I mean, Night Games, I absolutely love that song. Big hit here in the UK. Yeah. And it was Edwin Hamilton, I think, wrote that one. So tell us about that song in particular, because I love that song.
Yeah, that was before I did the Alcatraz thing. Yeah. Ed wrote that, and I thought it's great. I got a tape handed to me in New York, I remember. My manager was over. I don't know what I was doing, something or other. And I think I was on my way to Australia or something. Anyway, he presented this cassette. Remember those folks? he put it on your cassette machine, right? And I said, that's fucking good. I thought that immediately. It was in my head. It's like an immediate song, you know? It was so, I recorded it and it did pretty well. And then
it did very well indeed. But just in terms of that solo stuff then, I mean, because you did line up, the album came out, and again, it charted well over here in the UK, but you had some incredible musicians involved in that. I mean, guys from Status Quo, Francis Rossi and Rick Parfitt and Cozy was involved, and John Lord was involved, and Mickey Moody, as we spoke about earlier, Whitesnake and things like that. You had all these people. I think Russ Ballard was involved as well. I mean, how did all that kind of happen? How did you get all them people together for it?
Well, because of management Mickey Moody, you know, he knew John Lord, John Innes, all of them. Yeah. Was that nepotism? Something like that. I think it's called nepotism. I'm not quite sure if it is nepotism. Is it? I don't know. But everybody knew each other, or, you know, whatever. And so John Lord comes in and blah, blah, blah. Of course, Cozy. Who else would play drum? And we had different ideas about bass players, I seem to remember. But I was just lucky to know all these musicians. They came in and they made a freaking great album. It was such a treat to go into the studio every day or every other day and just sit with those guys and go, okay, what we're going to do now. And then Russ Ballard came in, who wrote Since You've Been Gone. And he had a couple of songs on the album that he'd written for me. But I always remember John coming in, John Lord. And we're all sitting in our little spaces, you know, with our baffle boards. I was sitting in one little thing, little like, you know, their boards are blah, 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 drums over there, blah, 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 like that. And I'm sitting there and I look over and I said, where's John? And Mickey said, I don't know. I think he's on to the shop. Oh, okay. So I'm sitting there waiting and I hear this rattling of bottles. And John comes in, you know, he's got his baffle there. Gentlemen, the bar is open. It's like 9 o'clock in the freaking morning. But the bar was definitely open. It's my bloody 12, you know. It was amazing. But no, we weren't shit-faced, but it did help a little. We got on so well, and I'm very proud of that album. I really am. I'll never forget John coming and doing that. It's etched in my memory. It really is.
Fantastic memories. And then just quickly touching on Alcatraz, as you said, you did some fantastic records and music with them. But a couple of guitarists you worked with in there, a young Yngwie, I think he was a teenager at the time, was involved. And then Steve Vai came in as well. I mean, incredible names. I mean, talk to me about each of those guys and what they were like to play with and work with and what were they like as people?
Yeah, well, I mean, Yngwie was, he was 19. And we were looking for, I've got a bass player and a keyboard player of sorts together. And I had a drummer at that time. And one of the guys in the band said, we've heard from this guy in the shop, there's a really good bass player. They're in a record shop or something. A really good guitar player. A young kid called Yngwie. What? And what's his name? So I got his number. I called him up and I said, would you like to come to audition with us? And he said, who is this? Who's making a fucking joke with me? I said, no, this really is me. You know, it's Graham. It's the real Graham. And he says, oh, no, is it? You know, anyway, we told him about where the rehearsal room was. And I remember he was with his friends in the car, I guess all ready to drive away, having a joke pulled on him. And he was sitting there. And he looked out the car and went, oh, this was when he liked me. It got worse as the days went on. But, you know, it was, he walked into the rehearsal room, and I asked him to play a song that wasn't a Rainbow song. It was my song from my album. It was SOS, a song called SOS from the lineup album. Because I wanted to see what he would do with it. You know, I didn't want to go, I didn't want the wheedly wheedly. And he came and he played the balls out. He said, fuck. And I looked at the guy, this is the guy. Then we did some, you know, heavy stuff, man. You know, Snails came out, you know. So we did some heavier stuff. And he was just perfect, absolutely perfect. I mean, he just did not miss a note. He plays like so fast and everything, but what he played was soulful, you know. Mm-hmm. And most wheedly wheedlies, they just play to show you their scale. I know I'll do a scale in C minor or whatever, you know. But this guy had a feel, and that's what I liked about him. Because we'd already auditioned a bunch of other people, and it wasn't the same. But Yngwie, he was just magic. And how could you fail such a great player? And I want to look around for a better keyboard player and a better bass player, but I wasn't satisfied with that. Anyway, that doesn't matter now. So we made our first album, and that's when Yngwie became a star, really, from that album. Everybody loved it. You know, we were on tour with Ted Nugent. I remember Ted coming into, after the first gig, I remember Ted coming into the dressing room after our show, he said, he walked in and goes, don't lose this guy. Pointed to Yngwie. Well, he's pretty cool too. So that's how that started, you know. And, you know, that's a great album. We did it pretty quickly. I wasn't too excited about the production. But anyway, that was our first album that got a lot of recognition. Yeah. Alcatraz.
Absolutely. That's fun for Alcatraz, yeah. And in terms of Yngwie then, because obviously he was getting a lot of the limelight, wasn't he, at this stage? So with him leaving after the first record, was that because his star was shining bright and he wanted to go and chase that? Or was it you decided to move him on? Or what happened there?
Yeah, well, he was looking for something better because he wasn't too thrilled with the other guys in the band either, like I was.
Okay.
You know, I was looking for somebody who was like a real shit-hot keyboard player, a really shit-hot bass player, which I didn't find. Well, we got somebody who would do, because we had to make this record. And he knew people were watching every night he went on stage. They watched this kid do all this and that. You know, people are aghast. You know, how's he do that? I mean, now it's like commonplace. Everybody bloody plays like that now. But, you know, he's out there. He's taller than me by about 4 inches, I think. And he had his high heels on his Cuban Hill boots. And he would come out. But he started doing that while I was trying to sing a verse of a song. Yngwie, you know, when I, after the show, you know, when I get to this bit, I've got to have the stage here. This is my bit. This is where I'm singing the verse, whatever it may be. But he was playing through everything because people were looking at him. He wanted to be seen. And I thought, well, this guy's going to go. He's looking to go on to something else, which eventually happened. Because what happened one night, I don't know if you heard the story, but he grabbed me. I went off stage, and I went off to the bus, and he came off stage and grabbed me by the throat and started pressing in here. Like it's really hard, trying to destroy my tonsils and whatever else. And I was going, what were you doing? You said, you fucking bastard, you pulled my fucking cord out of my guitar when I drew my lead. And I didn't at all. I didn't know. I actually walked off stage and had pulled it out by accident. because, you know, the stage was dark and the spotlight was on him. And I got up to the bus, you know, just to get some air sort of thing. And he thought I did it on purpose, which I didn't. And so he tried to kill me, basically. And it was, you know, it could destroy my vocal cords and my tonsils, whatever. As you said, he's bigger than me. And then our Yugoslavian, one of our Yugoslavian roadies, I remember him so well. Bless him, he died not so long ago. And he got hold of me, anyway, got hold of him by the head, put him under his arm like this, and said, "You fucking touch Graham one more time and break up his neck." And he went, okay. Because he was stronger and bigger than him.
Yeah.
So that night when we're driving home, we fired him on the bus. So that was the end of it.
Wow.
But he went on to better things. He progressed, whereas we went down the shitter. The man went down the shitter for a while, you know.
Indeed. So following him, we have to mention Steve Vai as well. I mean, another incredible guitarist. I mean, how did you find him? How did you bring him into the group?
Yeah, well, that came through our drummer, Jan Uvina. He played with Alice Cooper, and so did, Yngwie. I mean, Yngwie, bloody hell, I'll get the names right in a minute. Blah, blah, blah. Not Yngwie. He knew Steve Vai from the Zappa band, Frank Zappa. And he said, this guy has left the band, Frank Zappa's band. And he said, he's a really incredible, adventurous guitar player, you know. And Steve comes in and rehearsed with us. And I was just amazed by what he could do. You know, it's just, well, bloody hell. You know, playing a guitar like this, you know.
Yeah.
I remember telling my mum and dad, they came over to see me that year, and saying, we've got this guitar player coming. He plays guitar like a piano. You know, I remember saying that to him. What do you mean he plays like a piano? He doesn't go like this like I do. He goes like this. So it's just amazing. So anyway, after he'd done an audition with us, he was definitely in. You know, he was so different. And Steve said to me, "I don't play like Yngwie." I know you don't play like Yngwie. You play like Steve.
Yes. And
that's who you are. And I remember the first night he played with us, he was so damn nervous. He had his manager with him, but he was like sweating bullets, you know. Oh, geez. He was like, oh God, you know. And she said to him, "Steve, you're Steve, come on. Don't be so silly. You know, you're not a baby. Get out there, play." And he played fucking right. And he went, "Wow, what's this?" But watching a different guitar player, it's not Yngwie, but what a guitar player. What a songwriter, too. Me and him got so well. It was a little eye-opener for him. Good old Steve. And look, he went on to better things, too. It seemed like Alcatraz was a stepping stone for guitar players.
Because they had great grounding.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a shame. But I knew he would leave because he was so different.
Now, honestly, I could speak to you all day about your wonderful career, but it'd be nice to hear about what's going on now. The Graham Bonnet Band, I mean, you released an album last year, Day Out in Nowhere, which got so many great reviews. I've got a couple here. Just Classic Rock Louder said, sonic boom of a voice remains intact. Giant sounding instrumentation and thought-provoking songs. Metal Gods TV said, your vocals soar majestically over the finest of classic metal riffs. It's a wondrous record. Some fantastic reviews. So talk to me about this album then, Graham.
Yeah, I'm very proud of it. I think it's the best album the GB band, not the Bee Gees, the Graham Bonnet Band. Hey, you know, GB, Bee Gees. It's there from the beginning. BG, GB. I think this one we've done, this is the third one. And Conrad Pesonado, he's our guitar player and also produces the album. I mean, he's great. He's really good. He knows my voice inside out. And so had the right microphone, everything for what comes out of here, you know. And I've always, over the years, it's always been hard for producers or engineers to find the right microphone for me. And this time, you know, don't ask me the serial number, I can't remember what it is. It's a good microphone. But over the years, you know, I've had some. I remember one day when I was, you know, in the marbles, me and my cousin, I was recording something, and I was in the middle of a verse or whatever, and the engineer came downstairs and said, What did you hit? He said, you bust the microphone. Well, I mean, anything. I'd broken something inside the microphone.
With wow.
The little, metal strip.
Yep.
Was snapped. In this mic. I don't know what kind of mic it was. No idea. But he said, that's a snap. He said, listen. He said, come listen. I got part of the verse and then gone. And so Conrad's very up on that, and he knows microphones and gear and all that inside there. He's a guitar, you know, what can I say? But I think this album we've just made, although the other ones are good too, I think they're really good. There's a subject matter, a lot of people said, well, it's nice to hear you write about David's mom. That's one title called David's mom. Mm-hmm. What the fuck is that? And it's about this experience I had when I was about 7 years old, seeing this woman. Anyway, you have to listen to the album. And then, you know, I've written some of the odd titles that people don't know, well, what is that? You know, so it grabs your interest straight away. So you listen. So the first line should always be, you know, sort of ear catching, like, I can't think of anything now. But the first line is always the hardest part. You know, I can't think of any particular lyric. But it should always take you into like, oh, what happens next? And this is what David's mom is about, you know. But it's about me being 7 years old and going to see my friends. And David's mom says, I'll take you, boys. I'll take you downtown. Oh, thanks. Yeah. And what she did as she was getting ready to take us downtown. And there she was. She came into the room. I was sitting there waiting for her. David, so my mum's going to take us, she's going to drive us into town. And his mum, he left, and then his mum comes in, I will never forget this. She was very slim, short cropped black hair, very slim, and she had this black dress on. I've got you already, haven't I? She comes in, she's very cockney. All right, Brian. And she says, just a minute, I've got to get ready. And on one of the chairs by the fireplace were hanging these black silk stockings. And so, yeah, so she picked them up and she slammed them on and talking to me as she's put them on. And I'm going, frozen. I thought I just died. But that was my first experience as a 7 or 8 year old kid. A weird feeling. That I couldn't understand. But I remember putting them on and stepping the guard into place, and it's just, and it's David's mom.
And David's mom.
The song is about. And it's
fantastic stuff.
Very refreshing.
Indeed. Well, it's brilliant to hear that you're still so, so busy and on the road and recording with two different things on the go and different projects. Yeah. It's fantastic that you're still enjoying music and enjoying life and everything.
Yeah. I mean, this is. This is the best. I just love getting into the studio and making up new songs. There's nothing like it. You know, it's it makes me glad that I'm still alive, you know. I lost my brother about 5 years ago. He was only 70, younger than me now. He was only 73. And it was Alzheimer's. And I don't want to go down that street, you know. I lost my dad at 92 with Alzheimer's. And it kind of runs in our family. And I just, now I'm 75, I'm going, oh, shit. Is it going to happen to me too? But I don't think so. I think I'm still pretty much, you know, sharp, or whatever it is. I remember saying to my brother, the last time I saw Tony, Bethany and I were in a pub in England. And Tony was there. And he had one of my glasses case, one of the Ray-Bans cases. And I watched Tony trying to click the lid together, you know, the little press stub thing. Yeah. And I thought, I'll take it off and then do it. But I thought, no, I won't. I'll let him struggle. And he kept on going. It took him, I don't know how many times before he actually went click. I said, you got it, Tony. You got it. At this point, he was almost losing it, you know, understanding what he was saying. He wasn't talking very much.
Yeah.
But I love him, and he's part of the image, the comeback hair thing. He was the 1950s Teddy Boy, you know.
Yeah.
And he was my hero.
And, absolutely.
So my dad was 92 when he died. So, but it's an awful disease. It just takes them. They're dead before they're dead. You know, they don't know you. But Tony died, and that destroyed me. It's yours.
Absolutely. It's a terrible thing. Absolutely terrible thing, as you say. Well, Graham, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for jumping out of the bath quickly and sitting in front of the screen and the camera for me and chatting and telling me some wonderful stories. You remember them all so well. It's fantastic to hear and all these incredible things that you've done in your career. It's just been an absolute pleasure to sit with you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I'm listening out for the new album.
There you go, the brilliant Graham Bonnet there. Please do check out his recent work with the Graham Bonnet Band. Give him a like or a follow on the socials as well, please. And that's pretty much it for this week's big interview show then. Again, thank you so much for listening. Make sure you subscribe to Vintage Rock Pod on your podcast app so you get every single episode that comes out every single day. And if you can, leave a 5-star review on the podcast app that you use and look for Vintage Rock Pod on YouTube as well. Anyway, I'll be back tomorrow with more on this day rock goodness. So until then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.